From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Everyone was in the loop. There was a quid pro quo, and it was a continuum of insidiousness. Some of the comments today from EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland's testimony in the House impeachment hearings, describing what he called a quid pro quo, what Democrats are calling bribery, military aid, and a meeting in the White House in exchange for public comments from Ukrainian officials about investigations into the Bidens and Burisma, whose board Hunter Biden was on, and investigations into just who really interfered in the 2016 elections, even though all U.S. intelligence agencies say it was the Russians. And Sondland said it was a plan that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney knew about. Here's Intelligence Chair Adam Schiff and Sondland.
Now, in your opening statement, you confirm that there was a quid pro quo between the White House meeting and the investigations into Burisma and the 2016 election that Giuliani was publicly promoting. Is that right?
Correct.
And in fact, you say that other senior officials in the State Department and the Chiefs of Staff's office, including Mick Mulvaney, Secretary Pompeo, were aware of this quid pro quo, that in order to get the White House meeting, there were going to have to be these investigations the President wanted.
Correct.
And those, again, are investigations into 2016 and Burisma / the Bidens.
2016 Burisma. The Bidens did not come up.
But you would ultimately learn that Burisma meant the Bidens when you saw the call record, correct?
Of course. Today I know exactly what it means. I didn't know at the time.
Well, for those who couldn't watch all day, we're going to give you lots of recaps, starting with NPR's congressional reporter Claudia Grisales on Capitol Hill. And Claudia, Ken Starr, the Republican investigator behind the Clinton impeachment and a Fox contributor, said on Fox News, this could be a moment when Republican senators could make a trip to the White House as they did in the Nixon era, implying they would ask the president to resign. Your sense of how important this has been today?
Yes, this testimony has been very significant. He was making clear that he wasn't going rogue, that everybody knew about this quid pro quo. And it pulls these larger figures into the picture, closer into the picture, such as State Secretary Mike Pompeo and former National Security Advisor John Bolton and Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney and their roles in this Ukraine saga. And with these officials, Sondland claims he closely coordinated all of these plans to connect the presidents and the Ukrainians and the president's hope for these investigations to come out of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And he's making clear he wasn't alone. As far as he was concerned, nothing was secret. He was operating above board as far as he knew.
He also made it clear that the president asked him to work with Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's personal lawyer, but he didn't want to do it.
Right. He made clear that he did not want to work with Giuliani. He said the State Department was perfectly tasked and able to work on this Ukraine issue, and Giuliani didn't have an official role in this situation and shouldn't have had a role in this situation. He also said he didn't think it was wrong at the time, but if he knew then what he knows now, he wouldn't have done it. However, he said he was directed by the president and other top officials to continue to work with Giuliani when it came to Ukraine.
Yeah. And remember, Sondland is a hotel magnate from the Pacific Northwest. He donated $1 million to President Trump's inaugural committee and then got this appointment. It's not unusual for, you know, donors to get appointments. But at one point he said, I'm not a note taker. And that, you know, kind of made it clear because most civil servants, most diplomats are note takers, made it clear, you know, how new he was to all of this. But the ranking Republican member, Devin Nunes, was the first Republican to respond to what some would say was devastating testimony from Sondland. He didn't question any of the claims about a quid pro quo. He laid out what he said was Ukrainians backing Hillary Clinton and being critical of Donald Trump in the 2016 election. How else have Republicans been trying to respond to this?
Yes, Devin Nunes, as you mentioned, he opened this testimony calling it a circus, and he said, welcome to Gordon Sondland. Well, actually not welcome. We're not glad to see you, in the frustration, and calling Adam Schiff, the chairman of the committee, in his opening remarks, story time, and going after just more of the process, but not as much the claims that Gordon Sondland has been bringing to the committee today and in previous testimony.
You know, we know other Republicans are taking a shot at that. But Nunes also made the point, as if it was a new one, that people have questioned Burisma, again, the company that Hunter Biden served on the board of, as far back as 2015. He said to Sondland, did you know that? Now, I know I'm a broken record on this, but there was a lot of reporting on that, that Hunter Biden being on that board was bad optics and that Joe Biden's fighting corruption in Ukraine was a real thing. It sounded, in those few minutes we heard, as if the Republicans don't seem to have a comeback to Gordon Sondland.
Yeah, Sondland will be one of their more challenging witnesses to come after. For example, President Trump today reiterated he didn't know him very well and at one point even mocked his testimony. So, yes, it's going to be a difficult comeback for Republicans. However, we've seen them come back after these witnesses with new attacks. So I doubt there won't be some new ones
and
today after this testimony.
To the president saying, I didn't know him. Of course, he made a phone call to him that a lot of people heard. So,
exactly.
He knows him enough to call him. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, as the impeachment hearings continue, a handful of Democrats will be in Atlanta trying to convince the American public that the country needs a new Democratic president. Tonight, MSNBC and The Washington Post will host the fifth Democratic debate at Tyler Perry Studios. 10 candidates will take the stage, and the pressure is on. We are less than 3 months away from the primaries. Joining us now from NPR is NPR's national political correspondent, Mara Liasson. Hi, Mara.
Hi there.
Okay, so the Democratic field has actually gotten bigger since the last debate, but there will actually be fewer candidates on stage compared to the last debate. Who will we hear from tonight?
Right. The field has gotten bigger, but the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, is making the bar higher for who qualifies to be on the debate. So tonight we've got 10 people. We've got the top four candidates. That's Pete Buttigieg, Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, and Bernie Sanders. Then you've got the next tier, which is Senator Amy Klobuchar, Senator Cory Booker, Senator Kamala Harris. And then you've got the three, what you might call them, non-traditional candidates, Andrew Yang, Tom Steyer, billionaire, and Tulsi Gabbard, member of the House.
I see. I'm just thinking our attention is split. I mean, this is going to happen at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Those who are watching the impeachment hearings will likely be fried. I know I probably will. Do you think these hearings will overshadow tonight's debate?
No, I think that there are people who care about impeachment. There are people who care about the debate. Obviously, there's some overlap between the two. But, you know, despite the impeachment hearings, the Democratic primary battle goes on, and there are a lot of things to watch for tonight. One is that Pete Buttigieg, who has climbed to the top of the polls in Iowa, and he even is leading a New Hampshire poll, he's going to be in the hot seat because he's the leader now. And he'll get a lot of questions about his credentials, the fact that he is the mayor of the fourth largest city in Indiana. Is that good enough experience? Elizabeth Warren, I think, could be hit from the left and right about her mandatory Medicare for All plan, which she put out a financing plan for, then kind of backed off from it. And then you're going to have another big theme tonight. As you said, this is at Tyler Perry Studios in Atlanta, Georgia. That means there's going to be some attention paid to the African-American vote, without which none of these people can win the nomination or, you could argue, the White House.
Let's talk a little bit more about that specifically. A new Gallup poll found 60% of Democrats and Democratic-leaning voters said they would prefer a candidate who has the best chance of beating Trump. And those polls have been so perplexing to me because don't the majority, if not all, voters actually want a candidate they think could win? What do you think the subtext is behind
a
winning
candidate?
Say,
but the question is, would you vote for a candidate who agrees with you on all the issues or someone who has the best chance of beating Trump? That's what Democrats are doing this year. They're kind of voting with their head, not their heart. The problem for Democrats is, of course, they want someone who can beat Donald Trump because that's their first, second, and third priority. But they can't figure out who that person is. Polls show Joe Biden still on top in national polls of Democrats. Democrats like the idea of Joe Biden, but they're worried about his performance. Is he too old? He hasn't been able to raise any money. One of the questions about Biden is he's still at the top of the polls just because of name ID, or is he kind of like Donald Trump, that none of these problems matter? Then there's the question about Elizabeth Warren. She was climbing in the polls until she came out with her pay-fors for mandatory Medicare for All. And people thought, whoa, maybe she's too far to the left. Maybe a person who wants to take away private health insurance from 160 million people can't beat Donald Trump in a general election. So Democrats don't know what to think.
Yeah, yeah. You separated them by three tiers. Which candidates do you believe are hanging on by a string? Who will actually need to make an impression tonight to gain enough momentum for the next debate?
Well, every debate has higher and higher criteria. In other words, you have to prove that you're raising money from more people. You have to show that you're at a certain level in a certain number of polls. So I would say that Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, and Amy Klobuchar are the ones who really need to do well to stay in. I think that when you have billions of dollars like Tom Steyer, there are other ways that you can maintain your position. But I would say Klobuchar, Booker, and Harris are the ones who have to worry.
That's NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
We are following the big news in Washington. Testimony today from EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland saying there was a quid pro quo. Everyone from the Secretary of State to the acting White House Chief of Staff knew about it. A deal to get Ukraine to make a public announcement of investigations into the Bidens and the 2016 election in exchange for a meeting in the White House and for military aid. We want to get more analysis and a look at the other news with ABC political director Rick Klein, who's in Atlanta for tonight's Democratic debate. Long day, Rick. Hi.
Great to be with you.
What a day. Your thoughts first on Gordon Sondland, Trump donor, U.S. ambassador to the EU, one of the point men on what now has to be called the Ukraine deal. You know, the question seemed to be about how close the president was to it, but with all this testimony, there was definitely a move for a deal. Today, Sondland attached a quid pro quo to it. He said a White House meeting. Yeah.
This was explosive testimony. And you can add another title, which is star witness now in the impeachment inquiry, to say explicitly, yes, there was a quid pro quo, to say that all of the major officials up to and including the State Department, the National Security Council, they were kept in the loop, that they were acting at the direction of the president in coordinating with Rudy Giuliani. There were some caveats about whether this was connected directly to withholding aid or not, but the bottom line is this was explosive testimony, bombshell after bombshell, that adds a deep texture to our understanding of this episode.
Well, here's some sound I referenced a few minutes ago. It's Ken Starr, the former independent counsel who led the investigation of President Bill Clinton. He's a Fox News contributor, and he said today this on Fox News.
The real issue is the senators are watching. Are senators going to now say, in light of what we hear today, it's going to be a long day, even with the ambassador alone. In light of what we have heard, we need to make a trip down to the White House. That historic example set during the Nixon presidency. From what I've been able to glean, I don't think that's going to happen. But obviously, what happens today could, has the potential to be a game changer.
Now, we wanted to add that caution that he says, I don't think that's going to happen. But that was before Sondland. And the fact that he's even bringing it up on Fox must have been interesting. What are you hearing from Republicans?
Well, they are clearly concerned about what's come out today, and they're going to focus on aspects of the testimony. The fact that Sondland conceded to Republicans that he never got direction from the president. They're leaving the possibility that Rudy Giuliani was essentially going rogue on this, that he doesn't have documentation of some of these contacts, although Ambassador Sondland made the point that he wants some of these documents. The State Department isn't letting them have them. There have been no public signs yet of Republican break from the president, sufficient with what Ken Starr is suggesting. But his bringing up of what's known in Washington as a Howard Baker moment, where a senior member of Republican leadership tells the president, game over. I don't think we're there, but this definitely gets us closer to a different interpretation of all of these events. And I think you can see it in the anger from the president, for the frustration from some of the Republicans in and around the room. They realize that this day looks extraordinarily bad for the president.
Of course, the other issue is you'd have to have a Howard Baker, who was the Republican who told President Nixon game over. But you mentioned the documents, and I just thought it was interesting that Sondland made quite a show of saying that, yes, he wasn't getting the documents from the State Department, the State Department that he's sort of indicting, you know, in his comments today, saying that Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, knew all about this. But he also kept saying, because I'm not a note taker. I don't do that. And it just seemed to underscore that this is a newbie. This was a donor who was suddenly appointed EU ambassador, but then also Ukraine was in his portfolio. There are very few diplomats that I've met that don't take copious notes. How did you feel about his presentation?
Well, in some ways, it should make him Donald Trump's dream. Donald Trump doesn't like note takers. He also likes people that are loyal to him. This is a man that that raised $1 million for his campaign. Now, he's a more of an establishment Republican, but he's certainly not a never Trumper. He was named to this post by President Trump. That makes him a powerful witness, though, in deciding to come clean and deciding to say, look, this is how I understood things, and not deciding to line up and defend the president, defend Mike Pompeo, defend Rudy Giuliani. I feel like this is going to add pressure on the administration to release more witnesses, release more documents. Ambassador Sondland making clear he is not going to go down for this. And he is being as honest as he can be without attaching value judgments to his conclusions, acknowledging some missteps along the way, things he should have recognized as the EU ambassador, but a highly irregular set of circumstances that he was witness to.
Well, I was going to ask you, what are the chances of getting the documents from the State Department that he says will either help with his memory or prove what he's saying? And hold your answer, because we have the intelligence chair, the Democrat Adam Schiff, talking about how this scheme was known far and wide and kind of sending out a not too subtle warning.
We can see why Secretary Pompeo and President Trump have made such a concerted and across-the-board effort to obstruct this investigation and this impeachment inquiry. And I will just say this, they do so at their own peril. I remind the President that Article 3 of the impeachment articles drafted against President Nixon was his refusal to obey the subpoenas of Congress.
Rick Klein, your thoughts?
Well, a lot of this is going to get caught up in courts. And it's a reminder that we are not at the stage even of drafting those articles, that the Intelligence Committee is still technically just fact-finding to deliver information to the Judiciary Committee for articles of impeachment. So we're still pretty early in this process, as fast as things are moving right now. But today, I think, blows away any Republican efforts to dismiss the whole thing as a Democratic-led conspiracy. You have numerous officials, Trump appointees, people that are still employed in the Trump administration, saying that there was a quid pro quo, the top officials were in the loop about it, and that this was all going on at the direction of the president himself.
Yeah. A quick question. Some of the witnesses, including Sondland, are saying they didn't know in all the conversations with Rudy Giuliani and President Trump that Burisma, you know, make sure they investigate Burisma, meant Biden. Now, Sondland, maybe he can be excused for that, relatively new to this playing field. But Ken Volker, who was the former special envoy to Ukraine, also said he didn't know that Burisma was code for Biden's. And as he said yesterday, he found that appalling, you know, that Joe Biden in particular was known to be fighting corruption in Ukraine. You know, I'm a broken record here, but there has been a lot of reporting back in 2015 about how Hunter Biden being on the board of that company was not a good idea and how Joe Biden was trying to fight corruption. There, you know, no question about that back then. Is it possible that Volker didn't know that discussing Burisma meant Biden's?
You'd want to introduce these diplomats to Google, because it was very publicly known that that one was equated with the other. And the only reason of American interest in Burisma, which was brought up during the Obama administration, there were questions raised about the propriety then and continued to be raised after Trump was elected, was the connection to Hunter Biden and his job. So I suppose if you're the ambassador or in a State Department role, there's so many things that cross your desk that you don't necessarily connect the dots, but it was hardly private knowledge. And I think you saw Ambassador Sondland say today that had he known at the time that Burisma equals Biden, he would have raised objections.
Yeah. Look, you are in Atlanta because of the debate tonight. I'm sure this will be a topic in that debate. But what else are you expecting to be the main conversation?
Well, it's a head-spinning moment for Democrats because they have to break through in some way. I think the critical thing to know, this is the first debate where Mayor Pete Buttigieg is a front runner. And I think there will be harsh questions for some of his rivals about his experience, about his policies. We know that there will be questions raised, as always, about Joe Biden and the other frontrunners, but there really is a top four in this race, and I'd expect real scrutiny on all of their records. And I think a real challenge for the others to make a campaign argument, given all of the other news that's generated out of Washington.
Senator Warren has released a transition health care plan to try to answer some of the questions about her Medicare for All plan. Some saying it's too late. What do you think she has to do tonight?
I think she has to continue to hold her own against these attacks if they come from various directions, and they will come from various directions. I think she's able to, though. This is a moment where she can go a little bit bigger and talk about the larger stakes, because what is playing out now in Washington, where these senators would potentially be jurors and not just candidates, shows the stakes of defeating President Trump. And I think it's easy to turn as a frontrunner to the real task at hand for Democrats, which is not arguing over the details of healthcare policy, but defeating President Trump.
Yeah. Look, I asked you earlier about, this call for subpoenas on the part of Democrats, a warning against both Pompeo and Trump not to obstruct the investigation. But you said this will be tied up in courts. It already is. I mean, there's a number of people called to testify, Mick Mulvaney, John Bolton, who have joined a lawsuit asking a judge if they can testify if the president has told them not to, even if they're under subpoena. We understand that's not going to be resolved for weeks. I think the Democrats had promised to wrap this up sooner than that. What do you see happening?
What I've heard from Democrats is that they are not going to play by the time frame that they feel like the White House is trying to force on them with the deference to the courts. They think they've got enough information for articles of impeachment now on today's facts, frankly, yesterday's facts or last week's facts. They want to make the case as strong as possible, but they don't want to delay. They recognize what they think is a rope-a-dope strategy by the Republicans in trying to involve the courts. So they're not going to wait around for that testimony. Yeah. But I think Ambassador Sondland raises the question about what officials are willing to mislead investigators about. A lot of people are talking about the example of Roger Stone, sent to prison just last week after being convicted of lying to investigators connected to the Mueller case. So there are real consequences to not being forthcoming with Congress and with investigators.
Not to mention that there's things going on. I mean, the Senate passed legislation yesterday in support of Hong Kong's protesters. I mean, there are world events going on. And an election. ABC political director Rick Klein, he will be behind the scenes and on the scenes there tonight during the debates. Rick, thank you so much for giving us some time now.
It's my pleasure as always. Thank you.
I know you have the best intentions. You want to keep up with the impeachment hearings, but maybe you have a job. There will be hours of testimony from witnesses in the impeachment inquiry this week, and the NPR Politics podcast will be there every afternoon to keep you up to date on all the key moments. Listen daily.
NASA has announced 5 more partnerships with commercial companies this week that could eventually take cargo to the moon. The biggest names in commercial space travel, like SpaceX and Blue Origin, are joining a group of 14 companies that are part of a NASA program called Commercial Lunar Payload Services. The program gives NASA several options to send gear or experiments to the moon. SpaceX, for example, says it could be ready to do so in as little as 3 years. But it will also be a while before humans return to lunar surfaces. NASA aims to have 2 astronauts there, including the first woman, by 2024. That's looking ahead. But let's spend a few minutes looking back. This week marks 50 years since men set foot on the moon for the second time. Apollo 12 landed on the surface on November 19th, 1969. NPR's Jeff Brumfell has the story of why almost nobody seems to remember it.
Everyone knows Apollo 11, of course. That was the one with the one small step. And Apollo 13, the one Tom Hanks made a movie about. But what about Apollo 12?
The launch happened on a day the weather was horrible.
Teasel Muir Harmony is curator of the Apollo collection at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. There were thunderstorms that day, and the rocket was actually struck by lightning twice on the way up.
That led to electrical problem, a shutdown of a lot of the controls.
Okay, we just lost the platform, gang. I don't know what happened here. We had everything in the world drop out.
Roger.
Fortunately, the rocket kept flying.
I think we need to do a little more all-weather testing.
Amen.
And that was the dramatic beginning of what turned into, frankly, kind of a goofy road trip. Mission Commander Pete Conrad brought up a tape deck.
He thought they really needed entertainment.
Conrad, the commander, made the playlist, Dusty Springfield, Elvis, some classic country. He and fellow astronauts Alan Bean and Richard Gordon had all met as pilots in the Navy.
These guys were all friends. They all knew each other before they became Apollo astronauts.
Which really comes across when you hear Bean and Conrad landing on the moon.
That is, son of a gun, right down the middle of the road.
They were having fun.
I can't believe it. Amazing.
Pete Conrad's first words on the moon?
It's something like, whoopee, that might have been one small step for Neil, but that was one giant step for me.
And that may have been a small one for Neil, but that's a long one for me.
Conrad was joking about his height. He was short.
This crew was hilarious. There are a lot of really good clips. They were really entertaining.
Seriously, Conrad did a lot of singing to himself as he bounced around on the lunar surface.
Boy, do I like to run up here. This is neat.
The trip back went smoothly. Conrad let Bean drive the spaceship a little bit, even though he wasn't supposed to. They reached Earth and made a perfect landing in the Pacific. Got a hero's welcome from President Richard Nixon.
But they could tell that Nixon's focus was elsewhere.
He was trying to negotiate an arms control treaty with the Soviets. Meanwhile, in Vietnam, things kept getting worse. On the second day the astronauts were on the moon, pictures emerged of a massacre at a town called My Lai.
It's hard to feel optimistic and excited and focused on exploration when these horrible atrocities are happening on Earth.
Muir Harmony says Apollo 12 got lost in all the geopolitics and war and suffering. But for what it's worth, the astronauts had a pretty good time. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Some key moments now on a crucial day in the ongoing impeachment inquiry into President Trump. U.S. Ambassador to the EU Gordon Sondland told the House Intelligence Committee that he pressured Ukraine for investigations at President Trump's express direction. Sondland took a central role in the administration's Ukraine policy, unusual for the EU ambassador. Ukraine is not part of the European Union. Many Republicans have argued that only a first-person account could give Democrats grounds to impeach, and Sondland's testimony gets them to that. Let's hear some. In his opening statement, Sondland said he wanted to clarify three key points. He said these had been obscured by noise over the last few days, starting with the fact that President Trump's directives on Ukraine came through his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani.
First, Secretary Perry, Ambassador Volker and I worked with Mr. Rudy Giuliani on Ukraine matters at the express direction of the President of the United States. We did not want to work with Mr. Giuliani. Simply put, we were playing the hand we were dealt. We all understood that if we refused to work with Mr. Giuliani, we would lose a very important opportunity to cement relations between the United States and Ukraine. So we followed the president's orders. Second, although we disagreed with the need to involve Mr. Giuliani, at the time we did not believe that his role was improper. As I previously testified, if I had known of all of Mr. Giuliani's dealings or his associations with individuals, some of whom are now under criminal indictment, I personally would not have acquiesced to his participation. Still, given what we knew at the time, what we were asked to do did not appear to be wrong. Third, let me say, precisely because we did not think that we were engaging in improper behavior, we made every effort to ensure that the relevant decision makers at the National Security Council and the State Department knew the important details of our efforts. The suggestion that we were engaged in some irregular or rogue diplomacy is absolutely false.
Of course, Democrats are investigating claims that President Trump abused the power of his office to push the Ukrainian president for investigations into Trump's political rival, former Vice President Joe Biden, and that the White House withheld military aid to make that happen. Other witnesses have testified to that effect, and Sondland said Trump brought up the subject of investigations with him during a July 26th phone call that Sondland took from Trump in a restaurant in the Ukrainian capital, Kiev.
While I cannot remember the precise details, again, the White House has not allowed me to see any readouts of that call, And the July 26 call did not strike me as significant at the time. Actually, I would have been more surprised if President Trump had not mentioned investigations, particularly given what we were hearing from Mr. Giuliani about the president's concerns. However, I have no recollection of discussing Vice President Biden or his son on that call or after the call ended. I know that members of this committee frequently frame these complicated issues in the form of a simple question. Was there a quid pro quo? As I testified previously, with regard to the requested White House call and the White House meeting, the answer is yes. Mr. Giuliani conveyed to Secretary Perry, Ambassador Volker, and others that President Trump wanted a public statement from President Zelensky committing to investigations of Burisma and the 2016 election. Mr. Giuliani expressed those requests directly to the Ukrainians, and Mr. Giuliani also expressed those requests directly to us. We all understood that these prerequisites for the White House call and the right White House meeting reflected President Trump's desires and requirements.
And Sondland said it was no secret that those investigations were a prerequisite for a White House visit by the Ukrainian president. And he implicated other members of the Trump administration, recalling an update email he sent nearly a week before President Trump's now famous July 25th phone call with President Zelensky. That letter was addressed to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Secretary of Energy Rick Perry, and White House Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, among others. The Democrats' lawyer Daniel Goldman asked Sondland whether nearly $400 million in military aid was also a part of this quid pro quo.
At this point, by the end of August, I knew that the aid had been held up for at least 6 weeks. Is that correct?
I believe I found out through Ambassador Taylor that the aid had been held up around July 18th is when I heard originally.
And even though you searched for reasons, you were never given a credible explanation. Is that right?
That's right.
And no one you spoke to thought that the aid should be held, to your knowledge. Is that right?
I never heard anyone advocate for holding the aid.
And now, by this point, at the end of August, it went public and the Ukrainians knew about it, right?
I believe there was some press reports, you know, presuming or who knows, but I think at that point it became sort of common knowledge that everything might be tied together.
And, in fact, President Zelensky brought it up at that September 1st meeting with Vice President Pence that you were at, right?
I don't know if he brought it up specifically, but asked where the aid was, I think was more, I think he sort of asked, again, very vague recollection, because I don't have a readout of the bilateral meeting, but why don't I have my check, essentially?
And you understood the Ukrainians received no credible explanation, is that right?
I certainly couldn't give them one.
So is this kind of a 2 + 2 = 4 conclusion that you reached?
Pretty much.
Is the only logical conclusion to you that, given all of these factors, that the aid was also a part of this quid pro quo?
Yep.
And Sondland said he mentioned this delay in aid to Vice President Mike Pence. But Steve Castor, the Republicans' lawyer, tried to distance Sondland's testimony from President Trump.
But you testified that Mr. Giuliani was expressing the desires of the president, correct?
That's our understanding, yes.
But how did you know that? Who told you?
Well, when the president says, talk to my personal attorney, and then Mr. Giuliani, as his personal attorney, makes certain requests or demands, we assume it's coming from the president. I'm not testifying that I heard the president tell Mr. Giuliani to tell us, so if that's your question.
Right, but at your deposition, you said the question was at the May 23rd meeting when the president said, go talk to Rudy. You responded, he didn't even say go talk. He said, talk to Rudy. You subsequently said it was sort of like, I don't want to talk about this. So it wasn't an order or a direction to go talk with Mr. Giuliani, correct?
Our conclusion and the conclusion of the three of us was that if we did not talk to Rudy, nothing would move forward on Ukraine.
Okay. And then that was May 23rd, and then you never had any personal communications with Giuliani until August, right?
That's correct.
Castor also questioned whether the freeze on aid was politically motivated.
When again did the Vice President Biden nexus come to your attention?
Very late. Again, I can't recall the exact date the light bulb went on. It could have been as late as once the transcript was out, but it was always Burisma to me, and I didn't know about the connection between Burisma and Biden.
And to the best of your knowledge, you never understood that anyone was asking Ukrainians to investigate U.S. persons, correct?
Ukrainians to investigate U.S. persons?
Right.
No.
Okay.
No.
And just to sort of be clear here, ultimately the aid was lifted on September 11th. There was never any announcement by the Ukrainians about any investigations they were going to do, correct?
Correct.
The Ukrainians never, to your knowledge, started any of these investigations, correct?
Not to my knowledge.
Consequently, these allegations that there was a quid pro quo that had to be enforced before the aid was released, that never came to fruition, right?
I don't believe so.
Just some of U.S. Ambassador to the EU Gordon Sondland's testimony today. We will continue to follow this and other news.
And now to a controversial drug that helps regulate bone development and children with achondroplasia, the most common type of dwarfism. Researchers at BioMarin Pharmaceuticals say the company's dwarfism drug addresses the condition by growing the bones of children with it. But some argue it's a profit-driven solution in search of a problem. Reporter Damian Garday has been covering the story for our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. And Damian, this is the first drug that specifically targets dwarfism. Tell us more about it.
That's right. So achondroplasia, which is the most common cause of dwarfism, results from a genetic mutation that basically interrupts the process by which cartilage turns into bone. And so if you have achondroplasia, it leads to short stature, but can also lead to spinal issues down the road. So this drug is meant to account for the genetic mutation and to encourage bone growth the way that it would, or at least approximating the way that it would happen for people who were born without achondroplasia.
Okay, this study was conducted here in the United States, France, the United Kingdom, and Australia, and included 35 children ages 5 to 14. Explain what scientists found in the results from these trials.
So the patients in the trial who received the highest doses, they reached growth milestones about 50% faster than they were doing at baseline before they started getting the drug. So now there was no placebo group, so that's not a comparison we can make in this trial. But compared to baseline, those children grew about 2 extra centimeters each year than they would have, which brought them basically in line with their average heighted peers if you control for age and gender.
What has been the consensus? I know STAT contacted some people with dwarfism and Little People of America about this drug. What has been the response?
Well, that's what I found fascinating about this from the outset, is that there doesn't seem to be anything resembling a consensus. For some people, especially within Little People of America, which is the largest group representing people with dwarfism in this country at least, the fact that BioMarin is measuring height might make sense to them as a practical sense, but for a lot of people, generations and decades of activism have worked to explain to the world that the short stature that occurs with dwarfism is a difference to be celebrated, not a defect to be corrected. To them, to some people in this community, when you tell them that there is a drug that makes children with achondroplasia taller, and then you add to the fact that about 80% of babies born with achondroplasia are born to average-heighted parents, which would mean that if and when this drug is FDA approved, people of average height would be making decisions for people with dwarfism, you start to hear words like eradication or elimination of a community that they've fought to preserve and fought to gain respect for. But that's not the consensus either. So that's what's very fascinating. So you will hear words like elimination from some people, and you will hear words like godsend from other people.
You said that this is the first drug of its kind, but this is not the first time that there have been other treatments out there like growth hormones to address dwarfism and really short stature children. Can you tell me the difference between this drug and some of those other drugs and treatments that we've heard over the last few decades as possible ways to give people height?
Right. So growth hormone has been tested in achondroplasia, and it's just not terribly effective, mostly because it works so broadly in the body versus the BioMarin drug, which is very much designed to kind of home in on specifically the bone growth issue. The more common procedure, not so much treatment, is limb lengthening, which is a process by which surgeons break the bones of the legs and also the arms, if you choose that.
You actually wrote about someone who went through this, Chandler Cruz. Tell us about that person.
Right. So Chandler, as a teenager, she has achondroplasia. I think she was about 4'1" at the time. And so, yeah, she went through the process by which they sever, essentially break the bones in your legs and attach sort of a fixer on the outside, which has a multitude of studs that go into the bone. And each day for about 12 weeks, you twist the knobs on them, which effectively breaks your bones a little bit more to stretch them out. And then there's an ensuing 12 weeks of what they call consolidation, where you allow your bones to heal, to grow in new bone where you have done the sort of surgical injury, and then a bunch of physical therapy, and then you're back on your feet. And Chandler did this twice to her legs and once to her arms, and now she is 4'11", and would tell you it's the greatest decision that she's ever made.
Wow. In many ways, though, I can only imagine that this procedure might be even more controversial than this drug we're talking about.
It does seem that way. The thing that Chandler would say, and some people would say as well, is that, you know, when we talk about this drug and we talk about things that affect or might affect only height, Chandler would say, people say height is cosmetic. But for her, she didn't enjoy the psychosocial that are imposed on people who are of short stature in our country. In her mind, she would say, that's not cosmetic at all. That's a quality of life issue.
What is the next stage for this drug?
BioMarin, the company, has been running a phase 3 trial, which is larger, same basic patient population, but it has a placebo arm. If all goes according to plan, this could be a drug that is on shelves and available to the whole country come, say, early 2021.
That's reporter Damian Garde with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.